does a good job in proving the resurrection occurred, that the resurrection is a confirmation of Christ's claim. He does an excellent job in doing that. And if Christ is a prophet inside of a theistic universe, that does a real good job of confirming him to be the Son of God. But if there is no God, and you haven't offered any proof for God, then don't give me existential oddity as a ground for theism. That is certainly not a sufficient argument for the existence of God. The truth of the matter is that logically, you cannot have an act of God unless there is a God who can act. And R, event R, resuscitation of the corpse of Jesus of Nazareth, must be known to be an act of God before it has apologetic value for Christianity. For example, flight of the bumblebee is not a proof of the existence of God. It was very odd. Spontaneous human incineration is not a proof for the existence of God. Very odd. The resurrection as such is not a proof for the existence of God. It at best is a proof for a claim a prophet made inside a theistic universe, if you have some independent evidence that this is a theistic universe. All right, any questions about the view, evidentialism, the critiques, or response? That's a cosmological argument. We're going to get to that later. It has argumentative, rational aspects to it that apply to a whole world view that no one piece, no one event in the universe does. There we're talking about the universe as a whole. Now, if you can argue that the universe as a whole, that the whole universe, this whole circle here, suddenly becomes something that is contingent, dependent, caused, something that has a beginning. And you can argue that this whole show is contingent, not just a part of it. You can argue that the whole is dependent. Then that does argue for a God outside here on whom it's dependent. What Montgomery is doing is trying to take one little event inside the universe and interpret the whole universe by including the universe outside of here, which is not obvious from the universe here, that it must exist apart from some kind of cosmological argument. So yes, we are going to argue from evidence. We are going to argue from the nature of the universe to God, but we're not going to argue from one event in it. We're going to argue from the whole show. And that's a legitimate argument, because if the whole show is dependent, then the whole show depends on something. But how can you tell from the resuscitation of the corpse of Jesus of Nazareth as such that the whole universe is a dependent universe? He never attempts to show that, and I don't know of any way to attempt to show that. So that's not what their argument is. Again, it's talking in a theistic context. That's Paul talking to people who already believe it. And even in that case, even some theists, and I assume that the Sadducees were at least deists, I assume the Sadducees believed in a God, but they didn't believe in resurrection, didn't believe in miracles, so they'd be the equivalent of a deist. Even to a Sadducee, that argument is not going to be convincing, is it? Because he admits God exists, but he doesn't admit that God performs miracles. So neither will the argument be cogent for a theist. identical. That's right. Inside a theistic worldview, Montgomery's arguments have great value. In fact, they are the second step. All I'm saying is apologetics has at least two, really has three steps. God exists. This is an act of God to confirm the Son of God. The Son of God confirmed the Bible to be the Word of God. There are the three steps. Logically, this can't be the Word of God unless there's a God who can speak. Logically, Christ can't be the Son of God unless there's a God who can have a Son. And logically, the resurrection cannot be an act of God unless there's a God who can act. That's the deal. Now, psychologically, a lot of people can be evoked to a belief in God if you prove the resurrection to them. Say somebody who is a, let's call him a weak atheist. Let's call him a kind of weak atheist, agnostic type. He doesn't believe Jesus rose from the dead. And you come along and you whip out Montgomery's books and Habermas's books and McDowell's books, which I sell by the hundreds and thousands over the years by telling people they're great books, get them and use them for the second step. And this atheist, weak atheist or agnostic, reads the book and he's converted. Does that refute my view? No. It just shows that psychologically, you can evoke a belief in God through the evidence of the resurrection, not that you can logically prove it that way. That's all it proves. The psychological, now why is it that some people can be psychologically evoked into it? Because they know enough about theism, they know enough about the other arguments, they know enough that if God exists and miracles are possible, that this unusual thing, like David Hume said, if a man rose from the dead, that would be a miracle. That if that happened, that would be enough to convince them that what is in principle they already admitted is possible, and here's an actual example of it, just evoked their belief and they became a believer through that evidence. So I'm not saying don't use it. I'm not saying don't use it on an atheist or an agnostic. I'm saying logically, it doesn't work, and if he's a consistent atheist, it'll be water off a duck's back. So let's do it right. Let's do it logically. Let's do it step by step. And in apologetics, let's start at point zero. We're still there. And let's build on that step by step the way it ought to be done. And then evangelistically, just jump in anywhere you can along the process and witness to them, use any ammunition that you can use to do it. Absolutely not. And the record will show, if there's not an 18-minute gap in the tape, that I have said that at least three times in the last 2 days. I remember all three times. No, I'm saying apologetics and evangelism are two different things. Evangelism, you jump in where they are, and you go from there. Remember the thing on Acts we did yesterday, Acts 14, Acts 17, Acts 20. Apologetics deals with the systematic defense of the faith, deals with carrying it through logically, deals with how it ought to be done step by step. Now here's the value of doing it the right way, which is logically. Sooner or later along the line, the question's going to come up. It's going to force you back to step one. Sooner or later, like dealing with the pantheist. Oh, you can witness to a Hare Krishna, and you can get so far with them. But sooner or later, when you press them, you're going to get back to epistemology. I don't believe that this ultimately applies to reality. You may as well save yourself some time and effort. Do it right. Do it now. And then you won't have to do that later. All right, anything else on evidentialism? Non-contradictionalism is a test for truth. This is called systematic consistency, meaning that the view is true, which has no contradictions in it. And of course, conversely, a view is false if it has contradictions in it. So whatever system coheres, all of its major premises consistently fit together, is the true one. And all the systems that have incoherence in them are false. This would be Gordon Clark. This is an insufficient test for truth because, first, non-contradictionalism shows only the possibility of truth. That just shows there are no contradictions. It doesn't show it's true. There are a lot of things without contradictions that aren't true. There are no contradictions in any of the central premises of pantheism. So far as I can see, pantheism is an internally consistent system. The only reason we think it's contradictory is we believe statements like this, "I am God," are contradictions. But as we've already shown, that's not a contradiction. If "I am God" were a contradiction, God couldn't say it. God can say it truthfully and meaningfully, therefore it's not a contradiction. So there are no contradictions in pantheism. Pantheism is an internally consistent position. And Gordon Clark and other theists often make, and or other theists often make the following mistake. Pantheism does not fulfill our desires. They say, here's something that's wrong with pantheism. It doesn't fulfill our desires. Man has a desire to fellowship with God. Ultimately, pantheism doesn't fulfill that because ultimately pantheism says you're a drop and you fall into the infinite pond and you merge. You know, fellowship with God, you merge with God. Pantheism doesn't fulfill our desires. I have a desire for a happiness. Pantheism is the cessation of all desire. So it doesn't fulfill my desire, therefore it's contradiction. Contradicts my desire. Of course, what's wrong with this is pantheism does not fulfill desires as interpreted by a theist. Because I interpret desires as being fulfilled by God and having a positive heaven. They have a negative heaven called nirvana. So all I'm doing is superimposing my concept of fulfillment of desire on them and saying their view doesn't work because it's not in accord with my view. Or to put it another way, pantheism doesn't even believe you should fulfill desire. Pantheism believes that desire should be squelched. That's what's wrong with the world, is fulfilling desires and craving. So fulfilling desire is in itself a Christian concept. And we're saying, see, they're not true because they don't have a Christian concept. Well, now that's not proving they're wrong. That's begging the question, saying, I'm right in what I think desires ought to be with regard to fulfillment. They don't have it, therefore they're wrong. And inside a pantheistic system, that guy by the side of the road is all shriveled up and dying away. He is consistent with his presupposition because he's desiring less and less from the world and he is withdrawing, and ultimately he'll desire absolutely nothing and go into nirvana. That's his system, perfectly consistent. Repugnant to us, but consistent within itself. So non-contradiction is not a good test with disproving another worldview. A lot of them have no contradictions in them. Now, some of them do. I think deism does. I think panentheism has contradictions in it. But a good atheistic system and a good pantheistic system are both non-contradictory. I don't see any inconsistencies inside of a good atheistic system either. You say, well, he thinks that The universe is eternal. That's possible. Even some great theists said that's possible. Thomas Aquinas argued that the universe could be eternal. It's logically possible that the universe could be eternal. What does the first law of thermodynamics say? Energy cannot be created or destroyed. Possible energy has been eternal. It's just been rearranged. I don't see any logical contradiction in that. I think it's wrong, and I'll give you some arguments later why I think it's wrong, but it's still not contradictory. It's possible. And if it's possible, it's non-contradictory, then non-contradictoriness cannot be the test for truth and falsity. Second argument. It's possible for more than one worldview to be non-contradictory. Every system consistent with its own presuppositions is non-contradictory. But other worldviews are internally consistent, hence non-contradiction. As such, cannot establish one worldview over another. As long as you have this situation, let's say seven worldviews, and two or more that are non-contradictory, then the conclusion from that is that non-contradictoriness is not a sufficient test for truth of a worldview. Why? Because it didn't narrow it down to one. It didn't tell you which one is true as opposed to all of the others being false. So if two or more worldviews are internally consistent, then internal consistency is not the test for worldviews. Any question about non-contradictionalism? What Gordon Clark would have to prove is this. There are seven worldviews. Six of them have seven and only seven. There are only seven worldviews. Six of them have contradictions. Therefore, the other one is true. That's what we do. I will argue deism is contradictory, panentheism is contradictory. And then use, that just proves they're false. I've got the other ones, and I've got to use undeniability as a grounds for proving which one of those that remain is true. Only one of them is undeniable. All the rest are deniable. Okay, pragmatism as a test for a worldview. Pragmatism says it's true if it works. John Dewey, William James. Now, I know of no Christian apologist who claims to be a pragmatist. I know of pragmatic elements in certain Christian apologists. Francis Schaeffer has a pragmatic element. If it's livable, it's true. What's unlivable is false. On the popular level, however, even though no official apologist espouses it as the Christian apologetic, or even as his a Christian apologetic, on the popular level, the masses of Christians believe this. Christianity is true because it works in their life. We sing songs about it. We practice this daily. Pragmatism is the American way of life. Why is it not sufficient as a test for truth? First, the desired results may be unrelated to the truth of the view. For example, lying may accomplish the desired results. Just because you get the desired results doesn't make it true. If desired results prove truth, then cheating on an exam would automatically be justified by the grade you get. if desired results prove the truth of something, lying to the Internal Revenue Service would be true because you get the desired result. Second argument, results may be equally good for opposing worldviews. What we forget is that it's very difficult to argue my results are better than your results to someone else who likes his results better than your results. If you've ever witnessed to some real Mormons, I'll never forget one night witnessing to a Mormon dentist. And we went through all the arguments for Joseph Smith being a false prophet. And I really think if his faith had been grounded in reason and logic, that he would have been shaken. It wasn't grounded there at all. You know what his bottom line was to us? I don't care whether Joseph Smith is a false prophet. This is a good religion for my family. You show me something better for a family, a total family religion than this. This really works. That was his bottom line. So then the argument shifted from theology to epistemology. It shifted from apologetics and trying to show inconsistencies to showing him that there's something wrong with his method for testing truth, that the pragmatic method is not the right method for testing truth. Because that's all you can do. Once a guy gives you his bottom line, this works for me, therefore it's true, and you've got to attack his bottom line or you're not going to get anywhere with him. That's the value of starting it right from the beginning. No, so on our definition of truth corresponds to reality and truth must be non-contradictory and all of that, yes, but not on his. His definition is it's true if it works. Good question. The difference between pragmatism and experientialism is that pragmatism is a form of experientialism that looks to future experience rather than the present experience to confirm the truth. In fact, that's the way pragmatism is defined by William James. It will be confirmed by future experience. Tell you an interesting story about that. William James, who really invented and developed this theory, it's the only Native American philosophy, by the way. No other major world philosophy was ever invented in America. They all come from elsewhere. Pragmatism is our own unique species. William James and John Dewey are the two biggies. William James said, it is true if it works, and future experience will confirm whether it works. The truth is the expedient. What works, future experience will confirm the expedient. His colleague at Harvard, Josias Royce, said to him one day, Bill, if you got on a witness stand, would you swear to tell the expedient, the whole expedient, and nothing but the experience, so help me future experience. And what he was trying to show him is that his theory was all wet. And to use a bad pun, his theory wouldn't work. It wouldn't work because you couldn't discover truth that way. You couldn't discover truth if people got on the witness stand and said, this is expedient for me, therefore I say it, and future experience will confirm that it was expedient for me. That's the way to get out of a crime, not to be found whether you are a criminal. Lie is not justifiable because of the results. The answer is that. The end never justifies the means. The means has to justify itself. If the means doesn't justify itself, the end can never justify it. So if what you're doing doesn't have intrinsic approval, the extrinsic results won't make it right. I was called by Chicago Tribune when I was teaching there, and they said, as a theologian, what do you believe about Christians playing the lottery and winning? Do you believe that God ever answers prayer by letting them win the lottery? Is winning the lottery an answer to prayer or an indication of the providential blessing of God? My response was, I don't think winning is a sign of God's blessing or losing is a sign of God's judgment. I just think playing is dumb. I mean, if winning is a sign of God's favor, then losing is a sign of God's disfavor, right? I don't think it's an indication of God's favor or disfavor at all. I think it's just dumb to play the lottery. It's just an unwise use of money and stewardship. But if pragmatism were right, truth is decided in the lottery of life. See, truth, pragmatic view of truth is a lottery system. That the guy who wins, winning isn't everything, winning is the only thing. Wow. Is that right? If it ain't broke, don't fix it. So what we have is, I think, a cart before the horse situation here. If it's true, it will work. But just because it works doesn't make it true. Truth works in the long run. Telling the truth works. Doesn't always work in the short run, but truth works. Righteousness works. So first, the desired result may be unrelated to the truth of the view. Secondly, results may be equally good for opposing worldviews. Thirdly, pragmatism confuses cause and results. The results do not cause the view to be true. They merely follow from the view. But what follows from a view is the fruit, not the root of the view's truth. Hence, truth is not determined by results. The results are determined by the truth. Fourthly, pragmatism does not establish what is true, but merely what works. Because even after the results come in, you can still ask, are they good or bad? Are they true or false? Now, if the results determine their truth, you would not be able to ask the question of truth anymore after the results came in, because it's already determined the truth. But the fact that the truth question is still askable, meaningfully askable, after the results come in. Now, I cheat on the exam, I get the A, I can still ask, if I have a conscience, I will, was it right to cheat? supernaturalism is not a sufficient test for the truth of a worldview, because first, supernaturalism presupposes the truth of a worldview, namely theism. There are no supernatural acts unless there's a supernatural being. But the view that there's a supernatural being who intervenes in the natural world is a theistic worldview. So to argue from miracles to God is to beg the question, because you have to, first of all, have a God before that miracle, by definition, could occur. Secondly, to assume supernaturalism can be true begs the question with the other worldviews, for the other worldviews are opposed to supernaturalism. So to assume that supernaturalism is a true worldview, the miracles can happen, is to assume contrary to naturalism or pantheism, for example, both of which say that supernatural events don't happen. Thirdly, there are opposing supernaturalist views. What do you do about conflict within a supernaturalistic framework? There are views that claim to be supernatural and support, let's say, Islam. Some support Judaism. Some support Christianity. And then there are all kinds of claims inside of Christianity. So supernaturalism as such doesn't solve that problem, unless, of course, you can find that some of them aren't really supernatural. Some of them are just natural, demonic, psychosomatic, unusual, what have you, and that only one of them has supernatural claims inside of that theistic worldview, then that would prove their claim inside of that view. All right, combinationalism, that's the view of Gordon Lewis in his book Testing Christianity's Truth Claims, and also the book of his mentor, Carnell, from Fuller Seminary. Combinationalism says that if you combine a couple of the methods, usually they combine evidentialism and non-contradictionalism together. And if you combine a couple of these methods together, you can get a view called systematic coherence. And this is a sufficient view, because any view that all of the parts fit together consistently and it covers all of the data comprehensively, that view is true. So it's called systematic consistency, because it's systematic and it covers all of the facts and it's consistent in that it doesn't have any contradictions in it. Now, of course, it's possible to combine other views too and be a combinationalism, but this is the main form presented in Christian circles and the one for which a number of apologists argue. I think the view is wrong, because it simply combines two inadequate views, but combining two inadequate views does not make an adequate one, because neither view makes up for the inadequacy of the other. For example, if the law of non-contradiction in and of itself cannot tell you what's true, simply what's false, then combining another thing that deals with facts isn't going to help that at all. That hole is still there. That bucket still leaks. So what you really have is what's been called the leaky bucket argument. If I have one bucket that doesn't hold water because it has leaks, if I put it in another bucket, which also has leaks, the two of them together will hold the water. And the leaky bucket fallacy seems to me to be going on here in combinationalism. Adding another leaky method to a leaky method will just give you a doubly leaky method. It won't give you a non-leaky method. A dual criterion for truth with no way to adjudicate conflicts between the rational and the empirical test is a further problem. What if I have a conflict? What if the empirical thing says one thing and the rational criteria says another thing? Then how do I adjudicate conflicts between them? Because I've got two independent tests for truth. One would seem to be empirical, and the other would seem to be rational, and yet they two conflict. How do I decide which is correct? Just to give you an example, you've all had the experience of looking at a spoon in water. Empirically, it looks crooked. Rationally, you say it can't be crooked. It's a spoon, it's solid. The water is softer than the spoon. It can't, the salt, what's softer can't bend what's harder. Just put it in the water doesn't bend that. Seems to be a conflict between the two. What, which one are you going to give the precedence to? Well, most of us intuitively would give the precedence to the rational, but still there's a conflict between the empirical data and the rational data. And on a worldview, there are even more conflicts than these two. So it doesn't solve the problem by combining inadequate methods, and it doesn't adjudicate conflicts between the two methods themselves. Furthermore, a number of opposing views may be equally systematically coherent. In fact, I would argue atheism, pantheism, and theism are all equally compatible in the sense that they're all non-contradictory views, and they all account for all the data. Now, I don't like the way the atheist interprets some of the data. He doesn't like the way I interpret some of the data. For example, I don't like the way he interprets the data of the resurrection, calling it anomaly. I think it's a miracle. But you see, I'm prejudiced from my worldview point of view. I believe God exists, and that's got his thumbprints on it. On the other hand, the atheist doesn't like the way I handle the problem of evil. I say there's an absolutely perfect God, and he permitted evil. The atheist says, hey, if there's evil there, how can there be an absolutely perfect God? So we all have problems in our worldview, and from my perspective, his interpretation doesn't look correct, and from his perspective, mine doesn't, but in all honesty, I do have an explanation for evil, and he does have an explanation for the resurrection, even though they don't please the other person. There is an explanation, so he's got a comprehensive view, and his view is consistent. There are no internal contradictions in it. If that's the case, and I think it is with at least pantheism, perhaps atheism and theism, then more than one worldview is verified as true by this test. Now, if one and the same test proves more than one view to be true, which is mutually incompatible with the other view, then something's wrong with the test. It didn't do its job. Combinationalism then fails. Systematic coherence as a test for a worldview isn't successful. Likewise, all other combinations face the same problems, namely, no view makes up for the inadequacies in the other view. And secondly, it is possible that more than one view would qualify on the combined criteria, but a valid test must eliminate all but one worldview. Any question about combinationalism? Why it's not adequate to test a worldview? It's real good inside of a worldview. Once you compare the various worldviews and decide which worldview is true, and you decide, say, for example, the theistic worldview is the correct worldview, then when you look at given facts in the light of a theistic worldview, and you look at R, in a T world, theistic world, all events, even R, have a T flavor to them. With red glasses on, you can prove that red glasses are the glasses you ought to wear. With red glasses, everything has a red tint. So if somebody's looking at it through green glasses, the wrong one, he's got the wrong interpretation. He has the wrong tint to it. But once you can determine the set of glasses to wear, you can determine whether the person should see that as red or should see it as green. And the resurrection, I think, in a theistic universe, the resurrection is best explained as an act of God. It's not best explained as anomaly. But in a naturalistic universe, it's best explained as an anomaly. Because there is no God who could have done it. So it's best explained as something that just is unusual and not presently explainable. All right? Undeniability. I would suggest that this is an adequate test for truth. Notice I'm not saying it's the only adequate test for truth. I'm suggesting that it is an adequate way to test for the truth of a worldview. You could also do it by probability. You might want to note that which one has the highest probability, the greatest evidence in favor of it as opposed to the other one. But of course, if we can show by undeniability, that's a stronger argument. That's more of a knockdown, drag out argument, then it would be a more powerful case. Undeniability is an adequate test for the truth of a worldview, because what is actually undeniable is true. We've already established this. The laws of logic, we cannot deny that they apply to reality. Therefore, they must. What is actually unaffirmable is false. I do not exist is actually unaffirmable. I can say it. I can say I cannot utter a word in English, too. But it boomerangs on me. Grammatically correct, but it is philosophically unaffirmable. Therefore, what is undeniable is a test for truth, and what is unaffirmable is a test for falsity. If I can find something that is literally unaffirmable, like I don't exist, or there is no meaning in the universe, that's literally unaffirmable, because that statement is a meaningful statement, saying there is no meaning in the universe. Then I can say that's false. If Albert Camus and company come along and say, everything is absurd, like the myth of Sisyphus, roll the rock up the hill, let it roll down, to roll up the hill, let it roll down forever. Everything is meaningless. I want to know if he thinks that's meaningful. If he thinks that's meaningful, then everything isn't meaningless. So his view is really unaffirmable. If I say something exists, therefore God does, I think that's undeniable. Now the first part you can see is undeniable. I exist. Second part maybe you don't yet see. That's what we're going to do. Later on, but if I can show that it's undeniable that a finite being exists, and it's undeniable that an infinite being exists, then I've shown that theism is undeniably true, because theism is the view that both an infinite and a finite exist, at least one finite being and one infinite being. Pantheism is the view that only an infinite exists. Atheism is the view that only a finite exists. So if you could prove that only finite existed, atheism would follow. If you could prove that only an infinite existed, pantheism would follow. If you can prove that a finite and an infinite exist, theism follows. Now, there's more to it than that, but in an oversimplified way, that's the direction we're headed. Therefore, it is undeniably true that something exists, and therefore, if I can argue from that that God exists, it would be undeniably true that God existed as well. Now, why is this an adequate test for truth? First, because it's exclusive. It can eliminate some statements as false, all those that are unaffirmable. Secondly, it's inclusive. It can establish statements as true, I exist. Thirdly, on this test for truth, all non-theisms can be shown to be false. All of the other six worldviews can be shown to be false, because either they have some unaffirmable premise or some contradictory premise, and the law of contradiction applies to reality, too. And theism, Christian theism, can be established to be true because we can show theism is true, step one, by undeniability. Then we go to step two, and we can show by systematic coherence. In step two, by miracles, supernaturalism, that Christianity is true. Now, this is very important. If you don't understand this part of it, you miss the whole show. Undeniability is only used to prove theism. I have no undeniable arguments to show that Christianity is true. I wish I did. I wish there were a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, too. I wish I were a millionaire, but I just don't have any undeniable arguments to show that Christianity is true. My undeniable arguments prove theism, I believe. But when it comes to proving inside the system is a theistic one. When it comes to proving inside that system, what is true? I have to go to systematic coherence. I have to go to miracles to confirm that R is an act of God inside of a universe where acts of God can occur. So what is inadequate, systematic coherence and miracles, as a test for the truth of a worldview, becomes adequate inside of a worldview. Because inside of the worldview, I am not begging the question when I say this is an act of God, because I already know there is a God who can act. Inside a worldview, when I appeal to systematic coherence, saying this best explains all the facts coherently, I'm not begging the question, because I've already established the overall system. Now I'm just seeing how parts fit into it. And if this best fits, then that's the best interpretation of it. If in a theistic worldview, a resurrection is best explained by an act of God, then I interpret the resurrection as an act of God. Of course, it's possible that the resurrection is still an anomaly, but that doesn't best fit. That is not the systematically coherent interpretation. So then systematic coherence becomes a probable argument, not an absolutely undeniable argument, for the second step of our two-step apologetics. Undeniable that God exists, highly probable that Christianity is true. Undeniability is a test for the truth of theism. Systematic coherence, supernaturalism, highly probable evidence that Christianity is true. All right, any question now about the test for truth, how they apply, the inadequate methods and the adequate methods before we actually go about doing it? Why then is undeniability a test for truth of a worldview where systematic coherence is not? If you can answer that question, you have the point I'm trying to make. Why is systematic coherence not a good test for a worldview, but it is a good test for the truth of Christianity? Okay. And only one. Why is it that once you know the overall framework, the overall model, some interpretations of a fact are better than others? Why is it that when you know this is a theistic universe, that the resurrection is best interpreted as a miracle rather than an anomaly? Right? Because you have the right set of glasses on, you have the right interpretive framework to look at it. And so now, some events in the light of this interpretive framework will be better explained as this than that. Or let's look at it a different way. Let's suppose we can prove that it's an old woman in the picture. Let's prove that's the correct way to look at it. Now you know what to do with that. Is that an eye? Or is that an ear? If I say old woman and prove old woman, which was it? Was it the eye of the old woman, the ear of the young woman? Yeah, the ear of the young woman is the eye of the old woman. So if I can show that this is an old woman, that means that it must be to interpret as an eye. If I can show it to a young woman, it must be interpreted as ear. Same line, same facts. Because they fit now into that interpretation. So systematic coherence is a very important test for truth. Inside of a worldview, inside of a model, inside of a framework. But since the model itself cannot be established by systematic coherence, for the reasons just given, two or more views can be systematically coherent, then you cannot use systematic coherence to test the truth of the worldview itself. Systematic coherence becomes a step two in apologetics, along with miracles and other things, but not a step one.